From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We'll talk about some not-so-weird science on today's show. Science! A very cool experiment with artificial intelligence in a Georgia Tech classroom turns students into lab rats. And just what is plutonium, anyway? We'll find out later this hour. First, though, let's jump back to Friday's break room for a moment. One of the topics we covered was rapper Snoop Dogg's reaction to the remake of the miniseries Roots. Snoop says he's tired of movies and TV shows about, quote, black misery during an expletive-laden rant.
I mean, I don't understand America. They just want to just keep showing the abuse that we took hundreds and hundreds of years ago. But guess what? We're taking the same abuse. Think about that part. When y'all gonna make a motherfucking series about the success that black folks is having?
It just so happens we did not have any African Americans on our break room panel, which is unusual. So we asked for input from our listeners, and here are your first thoughts. Lamon Colley tweets, Snoop Dogg doesn't speak for me. That's the dumbest thing to say. And Jim Chaney reached out on Facebook. He says, quote, I'm not a black man, but I agree with Snoop. We are continuously reminded of our terrible past, which only perpetuates the idea of racism, which in today's society is still a very real problem. It's not enough we see it on the news every night. Do we have to keep reliving it in our movies? Let's start focusing on the positive and start to come together as a people, not continuously torn apart. We always love to hear what you think because it's always so thoughtful. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on the Twitter at OSD Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comment on the show. Prince Rogers Nelson would have been 59 years old tomorrow. His sudden death after an Atlanta concert in April seemed inexplicable to fans and admirers, but now we know the reason. An accidental overdose of the opioid fentanyl was the cause of Prince's death. You've surely heard a lot about opioid abuse in the news lately. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention call prescription drug abuse an epidemic. Prescription opiate and heroin abuse claim more than 72 lives a day in America. President Barack Obama addressed this in Atlanta in March at the National Prescription Drug Abuse and Heroin Summit.
It's important to recognize that today we are seeing more people killed because of opioid overdose than traffic accidents.
Dr. Patrice Harris joined us on the show shortly after the president's speech. Dr. Harris is with the American Medical Association Board of Trustees, and she's dedicated her career to battling opioid abuse. I asked her about the word epidemic and if that's an accurate way to describe what's happening today.
This is truly an epidemic. Over the last decade, we have lost more than 250,000 lives to this opioid epidemic.
Over a 10-year span, a quarter of a million people have died because of opioid abuse.
And overdose deaths. Yes, that's correct. And that is a staggering statistic, which is why this is certainly an all-hands-on-deck issue.
I would assume you have to go back to the causes of it and the rise in these kind of deaths first. So what is causing this huge number of people to overdose?
So like any complex issue such as this, the causes are multifactorial. We can go back to the late 80s and 90s when there was the general agreement that doctors were under-treating pain. And also around that time, there was development of new medications. And originally, there was some misinformation that the medications were not addictive. And then you can also add in the fact that it is easier sometimes for payers, for insurers, to pay for a medication than some of the other non-pill forms of therapy for an injury or for
physical
chronic
therapy
pain.
Absolutely.
So for those reasons and many others, that led to where we are today.
So we are assuming that a huge number of people are overdosing because they have been overprescribed?
No, we can't make that link. Some folks overdose. You start with the medication that you may get from your physician for an injury, but then people begin to take more than prescribed. They take the medication in ways that they should not. Sometimes there is an issue with others in the family or other friends obtaining the medication and, of course, using it because it's not their medication. So there are many pathways to that. And then we know that heroin, once you can no longer get pills, then folks turn to heroin.
And we're going to talk about that a little bit more. But, you know, the meeting of the national governors, they went to the president and asked the White House to step in on this particular issue. Governor Shumlin of Vermont said opioids are passed out like candy in the medical community. Is that a fair assessment?
I actually happened to be in the room that day. I testified on that panel discussion that day at the National Governors Association, and the American Medical Association and the National Governors Association are certainly looking toward ways that we can partner to address this epidemic. I would disagree, though, that the medications are being passed out like candy.
But they have, healthcare providers have written more than 250 million prescriptions a year for painkillers for quite some time. In 2014, 47,000 deaths were because of drug overdose. They were mostly prescription.
Yes, and that is why the American Medical Association has convened this task force that I am chair of. And physicians certainly welcome the responsibility to look at our own prescribing practices and to get more education, but also to look at this from a comprehensive public health perspective and work with the other stakeholders. This is a critical issue, and we must stem the tide of this epidemic.
So you and your task force have suggested a few things for doctors to do immediately. The first one is prescription drug monitoring. What does that involve?
Yes, so we are encouraging all physicians to register for and use their state PDMPs. PDMPs are prescription drug monitoring programs. It's a drug registry. So if you get a prescription for an opioid or another controlled substance, it goes into a registry when you fill it at your pharmacy. And then if perhaps I'm an ER physician and you come to my emergency room, for any reason, and one of the reasons may be you want more medications, I can then log on to that registry and see what other medications
that you already
have
a bottle on at home.
And if I find that, you have five prescriptions from five different physicians, that's a conversation that we need to have and talk about. And perhaps at that point, you have entered into addiction. And then that's an important conversation that we need to have. And I think a critical issue that the president raised about our understanding of addiction.
And that's the next thing on your list of things for doctors to do is talk with patients. Now, one of the complaints has been that even if we do identify somebody who is addicted, that the nation doesn't actually have enough drug treatment programs or effective enough drug treatment programs to get everyone into them safely and out of them safely.
We do not have enough treatment capacity in this country. And that, again, is another reason that has fueled the overdose deaths from opioids. Many folks who want treatment know that at the time you want treatment, it may not be available. You may be placed on a waiting list. One of my colleagues on the panel yesterday compared it, though, to how we treat folks with heart disease. She said that we wouldn't even think about a person coming in with heart disease and the community having to say, you know what, go home, and if you're still having this problem in 2 weeks, come back. We would not even think about doing that. And so we really need to look at the stigma and the lack of treatment capacity for those with substance use disorders. We also need to think about the words even and not use words like addict and junkie and stoner. Very, very debilitating stigma that also keeps people away from treatment.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the epidemic of opioid addiction in the United States. My guest is Dr. Patrice Harris of the American Medical Association. Is there a particular community that is more affected by this epidemic than others? Or is there a particular location or region in the country?
Well, we've certainly found that different regions in different areas are experiencing this drug in more severe ways. But we certainly have to say that no one has been spared. We've seen this in rural areas. This first started in Appalachia. And actually, that is significant to me because I'm originally from West Virginia. And I know that this was a significant and still is a significant problem in West Virginia. I've talked to folks who are working with folks in Tennessee. So I believe this first started in the rural Appalachian regions, but this has grown everywhere. And so it's rural, it's suburban, it's urban, it's black, it's white, it's young, and it's old. No one is spared from this epidemic.
Since you were at the event on Capitol Hill when the National Governors Association went and was talking to Congress about this, one of the things that the Governors Association said is that they didn't feel they were getting enough help from doctors and from drug companies. Could bringing the president into this help increase some of the collaboration between all the interested parties?
Let me say these are all conversations to have. It is important, and the American Medical Association is certainly supportive of state and local physician societies working with their own state legislatures and governors. And actually, that has been happening. We believe the solution to this is not a one-size-fits-all national solution. Each state and sometimes each region or locality in that particular state has to come up with solutions for that area. Now, there are certain things that we can do. We could fund, make sure that all these state-based registries are fully funded. As I mentioned earlier, they are a critical tool. Unfortunately, not all of them are fully funded. And sometimes the data is not reliable. Sometimes the data is not real time. So there's a place for many stakeholders, and it would be important for that to be funded. But I can tell you, and I'm here to tell you, that physicians are engaged. We have been engaged. We are now amplifying our engagement, and we want to do it on a more coordinated and collaborative fashion with all of the stakeholders involved.
We have a couple minutes left, and I just wanted to tell you an anecdotal story and see if it applies in other places, because I happen to know someone who is a veteran of several armed conflicts. He's on a number of painkillers, and it wasn't until they pulled him off them that he realized he was addicted. Is someone always aware that they may be addicted to opioid painkillers, or is that something that can happen without you realizing?
Well, I think when we talk about addiction, we are talking about, you know, we consider the medical addiction is folks who have substance use disorders. And folks who have substance use disorders, there is some decrease in the ability to function. They are getting in trouble. And so most folks know that something's not right, or yeah, I'm doing something, I'm taking more, but it can sneak up on you, and you may not be aware. But I want to make clear, and that's a good point, there are some folks who are appropriately on these medications in the least effective dose and for the right amount of time. So we don't want to have our pendulum swing so that folks who are on these medications, taking them appropriately, and they are relieving their pain to an appropriate level, that's okay. And we
don't want to
call them
addicted.
Absolutely. Folks should not stop taking their medications and make decisions with their physicians.
My guest is Dr. Patrice Harris. She's a member of the American Medical Association Board of Trustees. It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Just ahead, we'll break down one of the most misunderstood elements on the periodic table. First, though, let's hear about how one Georgia Tech professor pulled off a social experiment with his own students. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley.
Good morning, Celeste. How may I be of service?
Who is this?
My name is Hal PR885.
Okay, Hal, I have human producers that I prefer to robots. Sorry about that.
As you wish.
I'm really not sure robots could produce a radio show, but they might be capable of a lot more than we think. Students at Georgia Tech were part of a recent social experiment, but they didn't realize they were part of it at the time. College of Computing Professor Ashok Goyal teaches an artificial intelligence class every semester, and he enlists the help of teachers' assistants to help answer students' questions for his online class. This last semester, he added an additional TA, only this TA was an AI, artificial intelligence. Professor Goyal is my guest today. Hi there.
Hello.
And he's actually here in the studio, so I can attest he's a real person. Logan Gabriel joins us also. He's one of the students in the online class. Hi, Logan.
Hello.
So when did you discover, Logan, that you'd been asking questions of an AI all semester?
So it was actually towards the end of the semester. I think, you know, after the final exam, and Professor Goyle just made a post and said, hey, wanted to let you guys know you've been in an experiment, and one of the TAs, Jill Watson, is actually an AI agent.
Was that a surprise to you?
It was an absolute surprise. You know, the feeling that I give to other people when they ask me how I felt was kind of like watching a long movie, and at the very end there's this huge twist that kind of just shocks you and makes you, you know, wow, I did not see that coming at all.
Professor, what was the purpose of using an AI to answer students' questions?
You know, this is a very popular course. There are about 300 students who take this course.
Wow.
And they post something like 10,000 postings on the discussion forum.
Per semester? 10,000 per semester? Wow.
That's like 100 emails per day, right?
Yeah.
So we were thinking about if we could automate some of the question answering, the frequently asked questions, because otherwise it's an enormous amount of load on the teaching staff. So that's how we started. We thought we could just perhaps automate the answering of some routine questions there so that, A, that engages the students, because students ask questions at all time of night, over the weekend, and AI can answer those questions at any time of the night or over the weekend. And at the same time, reduces the load for the teaching staff.
Did you notice, Logan, that Jill happened to seem to be awake at all hours?
You know, I didn't really notice that much during it.
Looking back, you were like, oh, wait, yeah, she was awake at 2 a.m.
Right, yeah.
now, you found out, Ashok, that there was a series of questions that seemed to get answered over and over going back years, right?
That's right. So I have been teaching this course for quite a while.
Yeah.
And every semester, there were this accumulation of 10,000 questions, about 10,000 questions. And we could see there were patterns of those questions. Students asked the same kind of questions again and again. That's what we exploited here.
So, but when you first released the AI, not to students, but when you first gave her a shot at answering questions, she had trouble. Her answers were not very good. Why was that?
Indeed, you're exactly right, Celeste. Initially, the answers were not very good. And the reason was that when students ask the same questions again and again, they use different sequence of words. So I may ask a question like, when is assignment two due? Or is assignment two due on August 8th? Or will I be penalized if the assignment two is due on August 8th and it's submitted on August 9th? Same question, different forms. So initially when students would ask this sort of different question, same question with different forms, Jill would get confused among them.
Logan, can you give me an example of a question that you asked Jill? Do you remember one?
So I don't think I ever asked one, but I remember going back, you know, and a bunch of students also did this. We went back and we found some of the questions that Jill Watson answered. And it was, you know, more basic questions that were kind of just about the syllabus, or I actually believe the one that I saw was about when an assignment was due. And yeah, Jill just gave back a very simple and complete answer.
When you went back though, Logan, could you say, "Oh yeah, that was a perfect sign. This was a computer." Or does it still seem convincing when you read it, knowing that it was an AI?
Oh, I mean, absolutely not. If there was no announcement that Jill Watson was an AI, I don't think anyone could have known that it was. It was just a perfectly verbose answer that a human would give. So.
So, Ashok, does Jill Watson pass the Turing test? Let me remind listeners, we've talked about the Turing test before here on Second Thought. The Turing test was an old standard of AI in terms of, can the AI convince a human that they are also human? Would you say that Jill Watson passes that because she convinced the student she was a human being?
Since this claim has been made by several commentators on this, I hesitate to make a claim like that. That's a very strong claim. That's been a milestone for AI for 60 years. And I would be very cautious about a claim.
Why?
Like that.
What, in what way do you think she might not pass the Turing test?
I would put it slightly differently. I would say that it is relatively easy now to pass the Turing test without really having deep intelligence. So last year, or 2-3 years back, there was another contest in which somebody pretended to be a 13-year-old boy from Ukraine and pretended that he was having language problems and so on. And therefore, it appeared as if the boy, as if the bot had passed the Turing test. As it turned out, the bot really was not very intelligent. So the Turing test is a test of intelligence that requires deeper intelligence, deeper understanding that Jill currently has. But I can share another story with you that's going to come in fall. This will connect with something that Logan was saying as well. In fall, we're going to again have the same class. There'll be about 10, 12 human TAs. This time, we're going to introduce 2 or 3 AIs. We're going to mix them up, and it'll be the student's job to find out which one is the AI and which one is the human TA. So there'll
what
be
do they get if they figure it out?
Ah. I guess they get to take one of the AIs out or something.
Logan, do you think you could have determined if you had been given that assignment?
Maybe, yeah. But I think it would have been very,
convinced.
Very hard.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Logan, what do you take away from this? This was a class on artificial intelligence, and you didn't know you were interacting with an AI. So does that help you in terms of educational terms?
I mean, absolutely. I think it was a great example to show just, the path of technology that we're on. And I think in the near future, every single one of us will be involved in some way with an AI agent, whether, you know, it's a simple agent or a very complex one. So, yeah, I think it was great. Very, very inspiring. So.
What do you need to add next to Jill or whatever the AI's name will be? A sense of humor, maybe?
That would be great. We're thinking of adding some personality now. So if you're going to have 2 or 3 AIs, how do you make these two or
yeah,
three AIs?
How do you
AIs,
distinguish them?
How to distinguish them? So perhaps each one of them will have some kind of a personality. But I'm not going to tell you any more than that, because then the secret will be out.
Yeah, and then everyone will get an A. You're going
right.
to give them an automatic A for
That's
the whole
right.
semester, right?
Yeah.
No, don't hold him to that. I'm just speaking out of turn. So what do you then take away from this? What does this teach you as an expert in AI about what may be our next step when it comes to artificial intelligence?
I think there are 2 or 3 major takeaway lessons. One is that AI has now come to a level of sophistication that we can, in fact, introduce AIs in the middle of human society, and humans are sometimes unable to tell which one is human, which one is AI. The second is that...
Is that a good thing? Do you think that's a good thing for us not to be able to tell if it's an artificial intelligence?
I see nothing wrong with it. I think it's an exciting time. It's the beginning of a new era in which we start thinking about human intelligence and artificial intelligence in new ways.
I'm just thinking of, you know, all the science fiction movie we've seen where not knowing when you're dealing with a robot turns out really catastrophically.
But our AIs are all very nice AIs.
Famous last words. Okay, I interrupted you. And what were your other takeaways?
I think we are also at the beginning of an era where there's going to be a lot of social experimentation on how humans react to AIs. You know, we have been talking about AIs all this time, but now AIs are in our middle. We live with them, we play with them, we work with them, we learn with them. Would it make a difference to student behavior in the class if, let's say, Logan knew that in the middle of all of these students or NTAs are also 3 AIs? Would the students actually talk the same way, or will they behave differently? I don't know.
I don't think Logan, do you know the answer to that?
No, I honestly couldn't say.
And in the 30 seconds we have left, Logan, does this make you more or less interested in artificial intelligence?
Absolutely more interested.
Well, at least in that way, it totally worked.
It's a beautiful way of teaching and learning about AI.
I thought so, too.
I have been speaking with Georgia Tech Professor Ashok Goyal and student Logan Gabriel. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having
Thank
us.
Thank you. You are not a robot. You're lovable, so lovable,
but you just trouble. Guess what? Let's add 2 more songs to our Georgia playlist. That's our collection of the best songs from and about Georgia. The rules are very simple. All tunes have to be written or performed by a Georgian, and the musicians can't pick one of their own songs to go on the playlist. Today's selections come from an alt-rock singer-songwriter with melancholy tastes.
Daddy, please hear this song.
Hey, my name is Andrew Shepherd. I play in the band called Roadkill Ghost Choir. My first pick for the Georgia playlist is Two-Headed Boy Part 2 by Neutral Milk Hotel.
For a lover to bring a child to your chest that could lay at...
It's just, oh man, that song, I mean, that whole record is heartbreaking and beautiful and just so heavy. That song in particular is just so, it's just so sad. And there's like a sweetness to it, though. It's easy to listen to, but it's also has those moments of just devastating imagery.
Blessed up, please, with those wings in your spine. Love to be with a brother of mine.
All these kind of lines that I wish I wrote, you know, God is a place you'll wait for the rest of your life. Just heartbreaking stuff.
A struggle to find secret songs that you keep wrapped in boxes.
I like sad music. I'm drawn to it. And that song is, yeah, I think it's a beautiful song. And it's so great because there's not a lot going on musically. It's just, you know, pretty much him and a guitar, but his vocal and the way he delivers the lyrics themselves carry it and make it like something really special. It kind of shows you that if you believe in the songs and you have a clear picture of what you want to do, you don't need a big budget and you don't need really the technical ability to play your instrument. My second pick for the Georgia playlist is Crease by Thayer Serrano. So yeah, this song, it's really dark, really. I love, there's a lot of like heavy tom drum kind of stuff. And the guitar tones are always so great. How she performs and the sound of it all is just close to that spiritual kind of like, oh my God, like, oh, I feel it. You know, it's very dark. It's very pretty. It just kind of hits all the things that, you know, I really like about music and especially her music. The atmosphere of this track that I think kind of captured me. Sad music for me just makes it easier to navigate through the hard times rather than an obscenely happy song about the glory of being alive. You know, it's like, that has its place for sure. But yeah, I identify with more of a downer of a tune simply because that's the reality, I think, of being a human. A lot of the bands that I listen to and friends with here, there seems to be that common thread of everyone's trying to push themselves as musicians and as artists, and not try to be something that they're not. Everyone's here seems to embrace kind of like their roots of being from Georgia. There's always like, you know, that southern kind of twang that runs through, like that, it's like a little filter.
That's Andrew Shepherd of the Athens-based band Roadkill Ghost Choir.
If you have a song that you want to add to the Georgia playlist, we want to hear about it. Call us at 404-500-9457. Tweet us at OSD Talk, and you can nominate a tune. You can find the entire Georgia playlist series along with the great music segments we've done at gpbnews.org. Up next, tons of plutonium will soon be stored on Georgia's coast. Should we be worried? This is On Second Thought. So I sleep all day and I dream all night. With the bottle in my hand, I take the devil's side. I smile real late just to keep it hid. Oh, truth about my life. So I run like hell. The Nuclear Security Summit took place in D.C. in March. Our state came up in the discussions among international leaders. Why? Because Japanese and American officials have decided to send 730 pounds of highly radioactive plutonium to the Savannah River site. That's a nuclear reservation on the Georgia-South Carolina border. There's a lot of concern over this decision, and it will probably be hotly debated in the months ahead. So I wondered how many people really understand what plutonium is and why it's dangerous. And you know, when there's a word we all use but don't perfectly understand, it's time to break it down. Break it down, baby, because I want y'all all to know. Let me break it down for you again. Simply put, plutonium is a transuranic radioactive chemical element. It's a metal with the symbol Pu and an atomic number of 94. Does that clear it up for you?
I get it.
I don't get it.
Of course it doesn't. That's because that's just gibberish to most of us.
What are you saying?
Not saying anything.
You're saying something.
What could I be saying?
Well, you're not saying nothing. You must be saying something.
Plutonium is a metal that looks a lot like nickel until it comes in contact with air. Then it very quickly turns to a dull gray or yellow or even an olive color as it oxidizes. Plutonium is almost always man-made. It is present in nature, but you will not go digging in your backyard and stumble onto a cache of plutonium.
Oh, I'm sure that in 1985, plutonium is available in every corner drugstore, but in 1955, it's a little hard to come by.
It's generally created inside a nuclear reactor when uranium absorbs neutrons. Scientists discovered plutonium in 1940. It was the height of World War II. German scientists had just learned how to create nuclear fission, and Americans were trying to figure out how to split atoms in order to create nuclear bombs. A team at the Berkeley Radiation Lab in California put uranium into a large cyclotron, and the end result was the element 94. A note about its name. Plutonium was a continuation of the pattern for naming new elements based on planets in order of their distance from the sun. So there was uranium and neptunium and then plutonium.
Where do you look in the newspaper when a planet dies? The obituary. Get it? Orbit, planet?
One of the original scientists, Glenn Seaborg, suggested its symbol on the periodic table should be PU, as in PU, that smells bad.
Yeah, you got that stink all up on you now.
That was a joke. But the naming committee didn't have a very highly tuned sense of humor, and they accepted PU without comment.
Is that a joke? Can he make jokes?
Plutonium decays so quickly when it's exposed to air that larger pieces can boil water. And plutonium does not stick to magnets. That was a mystery for decades until in 2015, researchers found it had to do with the electrons in the element's outer shell. I won't go further into that because it's complicated. Really complicated.
One particle of unobtainium has a nuclear reaction with a flux capacitor. Carry the two, changing its atomic isotoner into a radioactive spider.
So why is plutonium so dangerous? Because it's highly radioactive. That means the element is unstable.
The simplest way to put it, I have problems.
It's throwing off invisible particles as it decays. Protons, neutrons, even electrons shoot into all directions. And when they pass through your body, they can actually screw up your DNA. Plutonium emits alpha rays, and they can damage living tissue more than any other kind of radiation. The alpha rays cause mutations in living things, and that then can cause cancer. And the more alpha radiation you're exposed to, the more dangerous it is.
Ah! Look what you've done!
So those are the basics of plutonium, but I'm not a scientist, so we decided to call one up.
Hello?
Nikolaos Kyriannakis is a professor of physics at Kennesaw State University. I asked him to grade our bid like he'd grade his students.
I'll give you an A-. That was pretty good, but you're missing some information that I can provide. Now, plutonium is radioactive because it's very heavy. So when you have very heavy nuclei that have many protons and neutrons, the strong nuclear force is not enough to counterbalance the positive effect of the electromagnetic force. And so that's why the nuclei are easy to break apart, and that's why they're radioactive.
He says plutonium is made from the same stuff as stars.
And the reason why it's hard to find plutonium on Earth is that its half-life is relatively short, so most of it has decayed away during the Earth's life. And the way to produce it is through nuclear reactions. So it is, I think, quite amazing that we can actually recreate conditions at the center of stars, or even seconds, fractions of a second after the Big Bang, the beginning of the universe, that we can recreate these conditions in the laboratory using, you know, high energies. And I think it's a quite amazing technological achievement of humankind that we can actually create those elements that could only before be created in the centers of stars.
So that is what plutonium is and how it's made. As I mentioned, 730 pounds of the stuff will be delivered to the Savannah River site in just a few months. Tom Clements has tracked the Savannah River site for 30 years. He's the director of the watchdog group Savannah River Site Watch, and he joins me now. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. Glad to be here. That was a great setup piece, by the way.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate it. And I wonder, what is your message, if you could give a message to the people of Georgia? Are you concerned about the arrival of this plutonium on the Georgia coast?
Yeah, the Savannah River site is pretty much across the river from Augusta, Georgia. Not a lot of people in Georgia know about it, but it's 300 square miles. It had five reactors dedicated to plutonium production, and it produced about 40 tons of plutonium over at Savannah River site. And at the site, there are currently 13 metric tons or over 14 English tons of plutonium at the site. So the shipment that's coming in with this 700 pounds is simply going to go into storage. There's really no clear disposition pathway for the material. There's no exit out of South Carolina for the material. And one thing about this kind of plutonium, it's weapons-grade plutonium, and has a half-life of 24,000 years, which means it's essentially going to be around for 10 half-lives or about 250,000 years. So this is a daunting task to deal with this material, and I really question why Savannah River Site is receiving more of this material when it really doesn't know what to do with the plutonium already stored at the site.
Just to be clear for everyone who's not involved in this kind of thing, a half-life is the measurement of time it takes for the radioactivity of a material to fall to half of what its original value was. That's accurate, right?
Right. And it's a rule of thumb about 10 half-lives. So there's a lot of other high-level nuclear waste at the site, too, that was a result of production of plutonium, and that's stored in originally in 51 large tanks. So there's a lot of materials out there with different kind of half-lives, but plutonium is one of the plutonium-239, the weapons material, is one of the longest.
We reached out to the Department of Energy. That department manages the Savannah River site, and they sent us a statement, quote, "The importance of keeping nuclear materials out of the hands of terrorists is clearer today than ever and is essential to protecting our nation and allies. The uniquely qualified, highly trained workforce at the Savannah River site are among the foremost experts in safely and securely handling nuclear materials and preparing them for disposal. The SRS community performs an invaluable service that is not currently possible anywhere else in the world." And I wonder, what do you make of this argument, Tom? I mean, first of all, the amount of plutonium that's already there, 730 pounds, isn't a huge. It's almost a drop in the bucket. But I wonder what you make of this argument that the plutonium has to go somewhere, and at least if it's at the Savannah River site, it's being handled by very, as the Department of Energy says, very highly trained professionals who know how to secure it safely.
Well, there's some truth to that. As I mentioned, there's already 13 metric tons or over 14 English tons stored at Savannah Riverside, and I do think it's stored under secure conditions. The question is, should more material come in? Now, if there's a nuclear proliferation risk or a terrorist risk of plutonium stored in a place where it's not secured in another country, then there may be an argument to take it to a more secure site that has experience. But if it's material in a region or country that already has a large amount of plutonium, then there's already, hopefully, secure storage. And I don't think Department of Energy has made a case why this material should come from Japan. And a large part of the material now being shipped from Japan is actually was sent to Japan for testing for nuclear reactors. It was from the United Kingdom. Why didn't it go to the United Kingdom? They've got over 120 tons of plutonium in storage. And DOE has made no attempt to explain why UK plutonium or plutonium from secure countries in Western Europe or Japan itself should be brought here. So I wonder what's going on, and DOE has really not even tried to explain to the public why we're getting material plutonium from countries that already have such a stockpile.
Now, you spent the weekend at the harbor. Why were you there?
Well, I went down. There was some news that this 700 pounds may be coming in. It's all very top secret stuff. We know the ships that it's transported on, and we know when they left Japan. Now, I understand from security reasons why you don't want to be broadcasting exact location and movement and stuff. But as long as the Department of Energy is not going to explain to the public why this material is coming in and what the disposition route for it is, I think we need to know as many details as possible without violating any security. The ships are armed, by the way, and they're based in England. So pretty soon we'll have a general picture of the arrival of the material. But DOE operates in secrecy. They're, even after it arrives and there's no security risk, they probably won't say anything. So my job is to get information out of Department of Energy, which is often acts like it's a black box from which it's hard to extract information.
The plutonium at some point has to go somewhere. Is your argument with it that it's other countries' plutonium that's coming to the U.S.? Is that your main concern?
Well, that's part of it. Some of the material they want to bring here is from Europe. Europe, France, and Britain both have large plutonium stockpiles, very large. Why can't they deal with it? There's been no attempt to explain why it couldn't remain in Germany. Japan itself has a huge plutonium stockpile, both in Japan and in Europe, that was separated from commercial nuclear fuel. And the shipment from Japan that's coming now, it doesn't impact what's going to happen with the plutonium already in Japan. So I think there needs to be a much more comprehensive U.S. and international policy on dealing with this material. It is a proliferation and environmental threat. And the approach now is rather piecemeal, and we here in South Carolina and Georgia are bearing the brunt of having to store this material with really no clear long-term policy about what to do with it.
We would love to hear from our listeners. If you got news that plutonium was coming to your community, would you be concerned about it? And do you feel like you have a good understanding of all the risks and how safe plutonium is? You can tweet us at OST Talk. My guest is Tom Clements. He's the director of the watchdog group Savannah River Site Watch. Tom, has there been any evidence that there is a higher levels of radiation around the Savannah River site?
Well, the radiation risk and environmental risk at Savannah River site is in large part from two sources. One is the 51 million gallon tanks that receive the high level waste that was a byproduct of separating the plutonium from materials that were inside the five basically military reactors. They weren't power reactors that operated the Savannah River, and those were last closed in the late 1980s. So that high level waste is in aging tanks. There's still 31 million gallons there. They're attempting to remove the waste and make it into a glass logs, basically, and that's an important program. And there's also low-level nuclear waste burial grounds on the site that are going to leak over time. They're already leaking some materials. They put a cover over one of the big waste dumps. But the biggest risk is if one of the high-level waste tanks were to leak into the groundwater or if there were a hydrogen explosion. And just to add, the South Carolina Department of Health and Environment Control calls the high-level waste tanks at Savannah Riverside the biggest environmental threat in South Carolina. And that means it's a big environmental threat in the state of Georgia as well.
So, I mean, as soon as you start to mention radioactivity and nuclear materials, people are going to be concerned about that. How much education do you think needs to be done to make people aware of whether we can make nuclear materials fully safe and make them more prepared to make decisions about what should or should not be in their community?
Well, DOE puts out a, Department of Energy puts out a, an environmental monitoring report for the various sites, including Savannah River, every year, and they basically say things are contained and okay. But it's the workers and the communities directly around the site, of course, that would have the most impact from what's been going on at Savannah River over the last 50 years, 60 years since it was established. And there is a an outreach program by the Department of Energy via what's called the Savannah Riverside Citizens Advisory Board, and it's worth people attending those meetings. There's actually a meeting on June 7th of one of the committees. So people do have ways to get informed, but in my opinion, DOE could do a much better job at informing communities around the site, particularly disadvantaged communities that might not have access to information about what's going on, what the potential threats are, and there needs to be expert analysis of what the Department of Energy is saying, as they tend to downplay the risks.
And your main concern, I just want to be totally clear, your main concern as a director of the group Savannah Riverside Watch is the new material that's coming in and not the material that is already stored there?
Well, we're concerned about those high-level waste tanks for sure, and are monitoring what they're doing. They're basically emptying the tanks. They leave some material in them and fill them with concrete, but we want to make sure that they continue with the project to remove the high-level waste and what's called vitrify it, mix it with glass and pour it into large containers. Mm-hmm. So that's a main focus, but we're also concerned about more plutonium and more high-level waste coming in, and right now, the Department of Energy is about to finish an environmental process on importing spent nuclear fuel from Germany, which even part of DOE has said there's no proliferation risk if it remains in Germany. And it looks to me like the site is out to make money on importing exotic nuclear materials, and the public really needs to pay attention, because once they get a foot in the door, I'm afraid they may be shopping around the world to bring in materials here that could have potentially a long-term environmental impact to the site and to South Carolina and Georgia.
Tom Clements is director of the watchdog group Savannah Riverside Watch. Tom, thank you.
Thanks very much.
That's our show for today. But as always, we want to hear from you. And we wonder, we just tried to help you understand what plutonium is. Is there a word you hear all the time, or maybe that you use and you don't really understand it, or you think most people don't? We'll break it down for you. Call us at 404-500-9457. Tweet us at OST Talk or post on Facebook. And you can find other installments of the Break It Down series on overtime, Social Security, lots more. It's at gpbnews.org. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day. Oh, no plutonium.